Welcome to the Together PDX podcast. You're listening to our Gospel Gathering series, where we will be replaying valuable content from past events where local Portland leaders gathered to hear from authors, theologians, and scholars. We'd like to note that the views shared by our guests don't necessarily reflect those of the entire Together PDX team. We pray today's content enriches your day and spirit. Welcome back to the Together PDX podcast. I'm bringing you the second of two talks with Dr. Mateus De Campos on reframing discipleship. Dr. De Campos explores how modern assumptions of discipleship don't always align with a biblical understanding. And in this section, he turns to the Gospels to see how discipleship is rooted in historical reality with its own theological matrix. We have a lot to learn from this scholar. So here is part two with Mateus De Campos, Covenantal, Eschatological, Cruciform Discipleship.
In the first, just to recap, we looked at how discipleship needs to be really resituated and reframed in its original historical context and framework, which is really Jesus' historical relationship with his disciples. And the simple exercise of doing that already helps us to see reductionisms in our modern way of doing discipleship in a context when discipleship has become a rather elastic and fluid concept. Understanding it against its original frame is really helpful. So prevents us from turning discipleship into just anything. But we also saw how Jesus' discipleship model constituted something of an innovation of the concept and practice of discipleship in his days. As I said, and again, hopefully you don't get too attached to this, but there is a weirdness about Jesus' model of discipleship that would be noticed by his contemporaries. So likewise, as much as we contextualize discipleship, if we are to retain its essence, we have to come to terms with the fact that there will always be a certain uniqueness to what it means. And that's okay. It's part of what makes it work. So what we're going to do in this section is to really explore two aspects of the paradigm. We're talking about this paradigm in the Gospels, and explore two aspects that makes the Jesus' discipleship model unique. And that's discipleship as covenantal and eschatological, and we're going to explain what that is, and discipleship as cruciform. Now, the paradigm of discipleship is reflected in different ways in all four Gospels. Hopefully, in a few years, maybe 1 or 2 years, there will be a resource available. I'm currently working on a commentary on the discipleship narratives of the Gospels, looking at all four Gospels and how they portray discipleship. If you plot the narrative of discipleship in all four Gospels, you arrive at a same general paradigm, but nuanced in different ways, and different but complementary ways. And for the sake of our talks here, we'll focus really on the Gospel of Mark as a basis for our reflection here. And there are good reasons, very good reasons, to start with the Gospel of Mark. The Gospel of Mark is recognized by most scholars as the first gospel ever to be written. So this is the first time that the early church is making sense of the Christ event by retelling the story of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. They're not just recording the events for posterity. They are really appropriating that story for their own lives and for the way that they understand their identity as disciples of Jesus. The Gospel of Mark itself is anonymous, but tradition strongly attests it was written by John Mark, who was for a period of time a companion of Paul in his missionary activity. You get that from Acts 12 and Acts 13 and other texts. Now, interestingly, Mark is famous or infamous for abandoning Paul in his ministry, which caused quite a grievance to Paul. So Mark himself has a checkered history as a disciple, which makes it very interesting when we look at how he portrays discipleship in his gospel. Now, the gospel was probably written to a broader Christian audience or with a broader Christian audience in mind, but more immediately, it was likely written to a persecuted community in Rome, the capital of the Roman Empire, in the mid-60s AD. It's interesting that the Gospel of Mark, being the first record of Jesus' relationship with the 12, and still very early stages of the church, has a very raw, honest, and transparent portrayal of the disciples. Some might say, I certainly do, even a negative portrayal of the disciples. Now, there are two important aspects from the historical context of Mark that helps us understand the reason or the way in which he portrays discipleship in this way. First, the gospel is associated with Peter, the apostle. There's one ancient source, Papias, that refers to Mark as Peter's interpreter, writing down Peter's memories of his experiences with the Lord. So perhaps the transparency which we find in Mark's portrayal of the disciples really comes from Peter's own reflections on his own failures and the failures of his friends in a very, very honest pastoral way. As a pastor, I find that vulnerability is a lost value in the pulpit sometimes, but it's amazing how effective it is as a tool of discipleship. So this, in many ways, comes from a vulnerable, open Pastor Peter expressing and explaining his own failures to his audience. The second aspect that I think is very important to understand the Gospel of Mark is the potential context of persecution envisioned in the Gospel. And that comes forward in different ways, really. For example, Mark structures his narrative around the suffering and death of Jesus. Specifically in the middle section of Mark, the entire section is framed around three death predictions, three times that Jesus refers to his death. A fundamental characteristic of discipleship in Mark is taking up the cross, a very clear language there indicating suffering and persecution. He emphasizes the inevitable persecution the disciples were to experience simply by virtue of being followers of Jesus. Another thing is that it's in a narrative that nobody knows what to do with Jesus. The big question of the Gospel of Mark is, who is this? Nobody knows in what category to put him. He calms the storm. He has authority to forgive sins. But he's a man. He's the son of the carpenter. Nobody knows what to do with Jesus. And even Jesus seems hesitant to say clear things, clear statements about him. Whenever people say things, he said, don't tell this to anyone. There's this whole narrative of mystery in Mark. The only moment that we have a clear declaration about who Jesus is when he's hanging at the cross. And a Roman centurion looks at him and says, truly, this man is the Son of God. So Mark holds that moment of revelation to the moment where Jesus is really most vulnerable, expressing his authority, his power, his identity through the cross. It's difficult to reconstruct with precision the historical events that stand behind these emphases, but it's widely recognized that Mark was written around a troubled time for the early church, a time when the pressure on Christians was ramping up, both from Jews and Romans alike. It was intensifying. So Mark describes the sufferings of Jesus not only as an essential part of his Christology, of his portrayal of Jesus, but also as a defining element of discipleship. Now, as I said, a distinct characteristic of Mark in relation to discipleship is this negative portrayal of the disciples. The group is portrayed as confused in relation to Jesus' identity. Despite seeing aspects of Jesus' self-disclosure that are unique manifestations of his divine identity, like him calming the storm or walking on the water or multiplying bread in the wilderness, the disciples continue to display fear and unbelief and incomprehension and spiritual blindness. Most surprisingly, a very strong term, hardness of hearts. It sort of makes us feel good when we look at Mark and his portrayal of disciples, because they are really a mess. They are really a mess. This incomprehension intensifies as the narrative progresses, with the disciples stubbornly resisting Jesus' cruciform mission. They abandon him, they betray him, they deny him. And interestingly enough, Mark leaves that narrative suspended, unresolved. Most scholars believe that Mark ends at chapter 16, verse 8, with the silence of the women going out and not saying anything to anyone because they were afraid. So it's a narrative that really, it's an uncomfortable narrative of discipleship. And it's the first narrative that we get, the first window into discipleship that we get in the early church. Now, we might justifiably ask, why portray the disciples in this way? Now, surely, one answer is it's because that's how things happened. They failed. But why make the failure a theme? Right? Mark makes the failure of the disciples, the incomprehension of the disciples, the blindness of the disciples, a theme in his narrative. If you are telling the story for the first time, why portray those who are now pillars of the Christian movement in such a negative way? The answer is probably in the pastoral nature of the Christian Gospels. So imagine with me early Christians gathered together in perhaps a rather inconspicuous place away from the public eye, fearing persecution around them, perhaps reflecting on how so-and-so had their business burned down, perhaps of someone retelling a story of how someone screamed bad things about them on the street. They're sensing the heat of the emperor's hatred for Christians building up. Eventually, Christians would be at the center of Nero's deranged persecution, as you know. You can imagine these disciples perhaps silently wavering, defecting, abandoning, very much like the 12 in the end of the story of Mark. Perhaps some are wondering about the legitimacy of their claims about Jesus. After all, they're facing this persecution and all this ostracism because of the outrageous claim that a man who lived just 30 years ago in Palestine, of all places, a man who died crucified by the Romans, the most shameful death one could imagine, that man had risen from the dead because he was the Son of God, the very manifestation of the God of Israel. Now, one can imagine how someone would perhaps have doubts and fears and abandon the faith because of those doubts and fears and confusion. So in that environment, right, an environment that not many of us can understand really what it is, that level of fear, in that environment comes the Gospel of Mark, which starts with the words, the beginning of the good news of Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. Claiming not only that this man was indeed the Son of God, and that understanding who he is crucial to follow him, but that his suffering and the persecution he experienced in the hands of the Romans was not an accident, but was the intentional embracing of suffering as the very means by which he would save the world. And more than that, that his suffering not only informs or makes it possible for people to be saved, but now becomes the very paradigm, the very model for their living. The cross in Mark is not just the means by which we are saved, it's the model by which we live. So the narrative of the 12 in Mark mirrors the experience of his community, the experience of the church. And that's why their story becomes a paradigm for the church. But at the same time, suffering becomes a paradigm for discipleship through time. God decided that his good news, the good news of his gospel, would have the suffering of his son and the suffering of his church as the very means by which it is revealed to the world. That good news, are not defined simply at random. They are defined by the experience of suffering. And we cannot ignore that reality when recovering and applying the discipleship paradigm. That is, by the way, one reason why prosperity gospel is not a gospel. Any version of the gospel that doesn't take suffering seriously is a watered-down version of the gospel. But I'm getting ahead of myself again. Before talking about the cruciform nature of discipleship, I want to go back to a more elemental component here. It's covenantal and eschatological aspect. Mark's Christology, Mark's portrayal of Jesus, is what anchors his portrayal of discipleship. The first thing that Jesus does in the Gospel of Mark, after announcing the arrival of the kingdom of God, is not cast out unclean spirits or heal the sick. The first thing he does is to call disciples in Mark 1, 16 to 20. At first, the scene looks quite pedestrian. It looks like a rabbi's interaction with potential pupils. But as we look in more detail, particularly against the context that we reconstructed in the previous lecture, we see some of that weirdness that we're talking about. Different than the rabbis, Jesus calls his disciples, a significant breach in protocol. Again, the candidates would normally approach rabbis asking for permission to follow. And here is Jesus calling disciples and calling unprepared disciples, not typical candidates that would have been prepared their whole lives in the study of Torah, instead calling people in regular walks of life. In the case of Mark 1, fishermen, perhaps the most pedestrian profession in that context. But most striking is the nature of the calling itself. And to understand the nature of Jesus' call, we have to understand the way in which Mark portrays Jesus at this point in the narrative. Because as Mark will tell us, the fundamental question of discipleship is the question that Jesus asks his disciples in chapter 8, who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Discipleship begins not with the disciples. Discipleship begins with Jesus. So Mark's Christology begins really with the prologue of Mark, the first few lines of the gospel. In fact, one might say that everything that Mark will say about Jesus in his narrative is anchored and dependent upon this initial claim. And here, we need to spend some time looking at where Mark starts, because Mark doesn't start the story with the story of Jesus. He starts with the Old Testament. And it's a crucial a picture to understand and to place the emergence of Jesus. Mark begins with a complex allusion to the Old Testament, the beginning of the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, or Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, "Behold, I send my messenger before your face who will prepare your way, the voice crying of the one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight." What Mark is doing here is telling us that the story of Jesus and the story of his disciples is not the story that stands on its own. It's a story that stands in continuity with and as a climax of the narrative of God's covenantal relationship with his people Israel. It's something that God's been doing in history and find its climax in this crucial, pivotal moment in history. Now, Mark cites Isaiah here, but what Mark is really doing, and it's incredible to see the genius of Mark as a writer when you really study these texts, what he's really doing is masterfully conflating three texts from the Old Testament: Exodus 23:20, Malachi 3:1, and Isaiah 43. And what all these texts have in common is that they all refer to an intervention of God in history, which is modeled upon the most formative event in the history of the people of God, the Exodus. So beginning with Exodus 23:20, "Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared." That text announces the coming of a messenger, coming of an angel, of Yahweh, who would guard Israel on the way to the promised land. Now, we all know the story. Israel was being held captive in Egypt, and Yahweh had rescued them with a mighty hand and outstretched arm, afflicting their oppressors with the 10 plagues, making a way through the sea for his people to pass. And now the promise is that he would guide them through a way in the wilderness to the land which he had promised them. So there's a whole divine intervention that moves from deliverance from Egypt to a way in the wilderness to arrival at the promised land. And this whole divine intervention is so formative for the people of Israel. It is this event that constitutes the basis of Yahweh's relationship with Israel. It is here, by virtue of this intervention in the Exodus, that Israel becomes the people of Yahweh. So when we talk about covenantal, the covenant is this the means by which Yahweh or Israel becomes the people of God. One of Yahweh's favorite ways to refer to himself is, "I am the God who brought you out of Egypt. I am the God who brought you out of Egypt." What he did in rescuing that people made them who they are. And Exodus 23:20 announces the sending of the messenger, who is the very guarantor of the covenant. The function of this figure is to guarantee. It's a visible manifestation, a visible guarantee that Yahweh would be with his people and that he would guide them on their way in the wilderness. So you have two key images here. The messenger and the way. Now, Isaiah 43, very important text for Mark. Mark cites Isaiah over and over again in his narrative. "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God." Further down in that text, go up to a mountain, the high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift up, fear not, say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. That was the expectation, that in the midst of their afflictions, God would show up. Yahweh, the God of Israel, would show up. Now, this is a context that happens centuries after the Exodus. The people of Israel find themselves again in captivity, but now in exile in Babylon. And Yahweh announces through the prophet that again he will deliver them in the same way that he delivered the people from Egypt, through a way in the wilderness. And again, there is a messenger. Hear the voice in the wilderness that comes to prepare the way in the wilderness. But interestingly, now the way is not the way of Israel. It's the way of Yahweh himself, of God himself, as he brings his people in procession from Babylon through the way in the wilderness to restore Zion. This is what scholars call a new exodus. Is Yahweh saying, the same way that I've done mighty deeds in the past with my mighty hand and outstretched arm, I will do them again. And this time is even more incredible. The anticipation, the expectation, it's just something absolutely unprecedented is about to begin, but it's modeled upon the Exodus. The announcement is that Yahweh himself is coming. In the same way that he manifested himself in the Exodus, he would disclose himself again in the deliverance of his people, and people would then be able to say, behold our God. So folks, one important thing to understand here. The one coming in these texts, the one who promises to come in these texts, is not just the king. It's not just a prophet. It's not a political liberator. It's not a rabbi. The promise is that Yahweh himself, the very God of Israel, will come on the way prepared for him by his messenger. That's the promise. Then Malachi 3:1, little bit of different historical context. It's after the exile. People are back in the land, but the situation is not like Isaiah had predicted. The priesthood was corrupt and the people are being led astray. And in this context, Yahweh announces again that he's coming, and again through his messenger, and again on the way. Behold, I send my messenger and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he's coming, says the Lord of hosts. But who can endure the day of his coming, and who can stand when he appears? Again, we see the sending of this messenger, but now the messenger comes to prepare the way for Yahweh to come to his temple to purify and cleanse Israel from her impurity and hold them accountable to the covenant. The promise comes with a threat. Behold, I will send you Elijah, the prophet, before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes, and he will turn the hearts of the father to the children and the hearts of the children to their father, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction. And those are the last words of the Old Testament. You have the anticipation that something is about to happen. Once more, this is not about the coming of a king, a political figure, a prophet, a rabbi. No, this is Yahweh himself, the one who delivered his people from Egypt, the one who promised the deliverance from Babylon. He is coming and saying, I will come to cleanse, but if you don't listen, I'll come to judge. These three texts combined, so what Mark is doing is pulling these three texts together, but these three texts combined describe Yahweh's authoritative intervention in a unique way. He comes in power and might. He comes to save and to judge. He sends his messenger to prepare the way for his arrival. Anyone familiar with these texts knew who they were talking about. It was about the coming of Yahweh, the expectation of this greatest divine intervention in history, when Yahweh, following the pattern of the Exodus, would come again to make himself known to his people and to the world in keeping with his covenant. So that's what those texts do together. And that's what Mark's telling us. This is happening in Jesus. He projects these texts and then he describes John the Baptist as an Elijah figure, an Elijah prophetic figure, the very messenger of Yahweh preparing the way of the Lord. And then he says, in those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee. A very, again, simple and on surface common sentence. But notice that Mark doesn't have a Christmas story. You're probably preparing your Advent sermons. I bet that none of them are Mark. Notice that there's no baby in the manger. In Mark, Jesus simply comes. Why? Because Mark wants to tie the arrival of Jesus directly with the coming of Yahweh that he just described. He comes on the way prepared for him by the messenger. John the Baptist is that messenger. So who is Jesus? Well, Jesus is Yahweh coming on his way to save and to bring judgment. That's Mark's primary Christological statement. Jesus is the very manifestation of Yahweh. He's coming on the new Exodus, on a way prepared for him by his messenger. This is it. This is the time history comes to its climax. This is the time that God steps into the world to save his people and to judge his enemies. That's the story. Now, what does that have to do with discipleship? Well, everything. Because by the time you get to chapter 1, verse 16, this very trivial, pedestrian scene of Jesus walking by the Sea of Galilee and calling the first disciples, there is absolutely no way that this is simply a rabbi calling disciples. This is not a rabbi calling people, potential candidates, for a journey of self-improvement. This is not a rabbi calling people to teach them how to read Torah, to instruct them on the doctrinal basis of faith. No, this is Yahweh himself calling and reconstituting a covenantal and eschatological people in his most climactic intervention in the history of the world. Is Jesus saying, I'm about to do something and I'm calling you to be a part of it. Jesus calling his disciples is an event of epic proportions. Chapter 3, verses 13 to 19, Jesus goes up to a mountain, and the text says that he appoints disciples, and the verb in Greek to appoint is the same verb. It also means to make. So it's a constitutional moment. So pay attention to this. On a mountain, he calls 12. Have you seen that before? Well, there's nothing trivial about that. This is a covenantal eschatological moment. You have Jesus coming as Yahweh comes. You have Jesus' baptism and temptation. What happens there? He goes from the water into the wilderness for 40 days. Have you seen that before? You have Jesus proclaiming the eschatological arrival of the kingdom of God. Then you have Jesus going to the Sea of Galilee and to a mountain and constituting a people for himself. You have him performing mighty deeds in front of people with hardened hearts. Have you seen that before? You have Jesus calming the storm and then drowning a cohort of enemies. Remember the story of the pigs, the demons and the pigs in Gerasa? Oh, where do they drown? They drown in the same sea that he delivered his disciples before. Where have you seen that before? An army of enemies drowning on the sea where he delivered his people. You have Jesus multiplying bread in the wilderness. Where have you seen that before? And then walking on the water, coming to his disciples and saying, "Fear not, I am." Sorry, the Brazilian is coming out of me here. Folks, this is not a rabbi calling disciples for a journey of self-improvement and discovery. This is God acting according to his covenant, calling a people to himself to join him in an eschatological task of epic proportions. That is discipleship. So in Mark, discipleship is described as covenantal and eschatological. And we see that throughout the narrative. First, in the calling of the 12, or the calling of the first disciples. He comes by the sea. He calls the disciples saying, "Come to me and I'll make you fishers of men." And this is a complete reorientation and reprioritization of the disciples' identity and vocation. They are fishermen who will now become fishers of men. This is brilliant. This is beautiful. Jesus picks up on their job description and resignifies it with an eschatological meaning. Because fishers was a metaphor the prophets used to identify Yahweh's helpers in bringing Israel back from their physical and spiritual exile. The call of discipleship for these men is a resignification of their lives. It's the most ordinary people with the most ordinary of lives having their whole identities and vocations invested with extraordinary eschatological significance. There's no ordinary existence for those who are called by Jesus. Because Jesus is no ordinary rabbi. After that encounter, the all too ordinary sea and the boat, which were so familiar to them, would become the stage of Jesus' self-disclosure. The sea is the sea that Jesus walks on. The boat is the boat he stands on when he calms the storm. Life still unfolds in the same ordinary places and spaces, but it isn't ordinary anymore. Notice there's a paradigm shift here. This is not Jesus coming into their lives. It's them coming into his kingdom. This is not them inviting Jesus to be a part of their stories. This is Jesus with his divine authority calling them to be part of his. That is discipleship. It's understanding that your whole life is now reoriented, resignified, reorganized. Well, that's the paradigm. The story is told in this way not simply for the sake of recording what happened with the historical disciples. It's told to inform the life of a community of persecuted Christians at the heart of the Roman Empire. This is the paradigm for them and the paradigm for us. It tells us about the nature of discipleship. It's being constituted as the covenantal people of God. Discipleship is covenantal. It's anchored in God's mighty acts, constituting a people for himself. Discipleship is fundamentally understanding that you are joining in something that God is doing from the foundation of the world. It's situating your life in the framework of God's act in history. It's understanding how your life fits with the call of Abraham, with the deliverance from Egypt, with the reign of David, with the saga of the people of God through exile, and how all that story finds its climax in the manifestation of Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God, in the constitution of his people. And understanding that your whole life, regardless of what you do, regardless of what ordinary tasks you are involved in this world, your life finds meaning in the story of what God is doing in the world in Jesus Christ. You see, this is an expansion of our lives. That changes our way of understanding discipleship. You see, sometimes pragmatically we think of discipleship in terms of teaching people what to believe and how to behave. What to believe and how to behave. But in the covenant, what you believe and how you behave is always a response to what God does. Sinai comes after Egypt. The giving of the Torah comes after the deliverance from Egypt. Look at this text. This is a wonderful text in Deuteronomy 4. Did any people ever hear the voice of a God speaking out of the midst of the fire as you have heard and still live? Or has any God ever attempted to go and take a nation for himself from the midst of another nation by trials, by signs, by wonders, and by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great deeds of terror, all of which the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? To you it was shown. Notice the language. You have seen. It was shown. So that you might know that the Lord is God. There's no one beside him. Out of heaven, he let you hear his voice that he might discipline you. And on earth, he let you see his great fire. And you heard his words out of the midst of the fire. And because he loved your fathers and chose their offspring after them and brought you out of Egypt, that sentence again, with his own presence, know therefore today that the Lord is God. Therefore, after all this, therefore, you shall keep his statutes and his commandments. In other words, you have seen what I did. Now you know who I am. And now you do what I say. We don't change people's behavior just by telling them what to believe and what to do. They have to have an experience with the covenant. They have to understand what God did in Christ in order to do what he says. Discipleship is still imitation, but it's an imitation that flows out of the covenant. Also important here is that discipleship is corporate. If it's covenantal, it's corporate, because God's covenant is not simply with individuals, it's with a people. Being saved is not just stamping your personal passport to the New Jerusalem. It's being incorporated into a covenantal people constituted around Jesus. Discipleship is not primarily an individual pursuit of self-discovery or improvement with God. Discipleship is not private. It's not just a personal practice of certain disciplines that will make you a better Christian. Yes, it is that, of course, but essentially, it's finding your place in the people of God. And we're not talking about a vague sense of community here. We're talking about a fundamental perception of belonging to God's people. In a real sense, you are who you are because you are part of this people. That's the importance of the church. By the way, there's no discipleship without church, okay? It feels like a given, but these days it seems important to say. I'm all for coffee shops, but there's something that happens in the gathering of the people of God. And may I be a little bit controversial here, in the physical gathering of the people of God, there is an embodiment that happened in the way that we share life together that is uncomfortable but necessary to shape our lives as disciples. Third, discipleship entails being called to an eschatological mission. Evangelical evangelism is a terminology of accepting Jesus as your Lord and Savior. And that's probably one of the biggest contributions of the evangelical movement, conversionism, a personal commitment to Christ. That's important. That level of personal commitment to Christ that we intensely emphasize. But ultimately, a disciple is someone who understands that they not only have accepted Jesus as part of their lives, but they have been called to be a part of His kingdom. It's a different paradigm. A paradigm which, by the way, makes a lot of sense to a new generation of seekers, the Gen Zers in our churches, who are not just seeking for happiness and self-fulfillment, but really for meaning. So it's really the ordinary life being transformed by the extraordinary calling of Jesus. Well, discipleship is covenantal and eschatological. And finally, discipleship is cruciform. This is the second aspect of discipleship, of the paradigm in Mark. And it emerges in chapters 8 to 10 of the gospel. This is what we call the way section, following the motif of the new Exodus. So Jesus is on the way. Various times, Mark emphasizes the phrase, on the way, on the way, on the way, on the way. This is the way of discipleship. This is the way to the cross. This is Jesus teaching them on the way. It begins in Caesarea Philippi with Jesus' emblematic question, who do you say that I am? Again, we see here a clear association between Christology and discipleship. Discipleship is fundamentally based on the disciples' perception of who Jesus is. And now, not only in relation to his self-disclosure through his deeds, but also through his suffering. The Son of Man, which is a terminology that Paul uses, Jesus uses a lot to refer to himself. In the first half of Mark, the Son of Man is the Son of Man who has authority. But in the second half of Mark, the Son of Man is the Son of Man who gives his life as a ransom for many, the Son of Man who serves. His authority is now conveyed through his service. So his servanthood and his suffering. Jesus' identity is now conveyed through the act of carrying the cross, as much as it is through his mighty deeds. And then there is a Sinai moment in the middle, the transfiguration event, when Jesus' glory is displayed alongside Moses and Elijah before the eyes of the disciples. A wonderful moment. And after that, you have a new Torah. Jesus begins to teach his disciples the way of cruciform discipleship. So after revealing himself as the one who has divine authority to forgive sins, after revealing himself as the one who casts out unclean spirits, who heals the sick, after reconstituting his people on the sea and on the mountain, after calming the storm and walking on the water, multiplying bread in the wilderness, in other words, after revealing himself as the very manifestation of Yahweh through his deeds, Jesus, like Yahweh, on the way and on the mountain, goes on to instruct his disciples on the new Torah. Now, interestingly, again, we're reading this against the Exodus paradigm. In the Exodus, the way by which Yahweh led his people in the wilderness was the way where God was teaching his people how to be his people. And it was on the way to the promised land that Israel failed the most in their relationship with God. Well, guess what happens in Mark? Mark is framing the disciples' journey with Jesus against that background of the Exodus. The disciples who had been following Jesus in his new Exodus ministry now are confronted in their own way journey with the need to learn what it means to be the people of God, learn what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. So discipleship, here's another thing. Discipleship is a movement. Both in relation to Israel and in relation to the disciples, we see a movement of formation and transformation of the people happening in a dynamic journey. Discipleship is not a season. You don't graduate from it. It's an identity that is constantly being shaped in a movement. There's not a point where you cease to be a disciple because it's an identity that is constantly being formed and reshaped. This whole section of Mark is structured around three death predictions by Jesus. And there's a pattern here. Three times Jesus says he will die. The Son of Man will die. The Son of Man will die and suffer. The Son of Man will die. For each of those times, the disciples exhibit some form of incomprehension and resistance. The Son of Man will die, Peter says, starts rebuking Jesus for saying that. No, you can't say that. The Son of Man will die. The disciples begin discussing among themselves who's the greatest. The Son of Man will die. Along come James and John asking for positions of prominence and glory in the kingdom. And for each time they fail, Jesus corrects them. So through Jesus' emphasis on his own suffering, through the disciples' failure, and through Jesus' subsequent teaching, you have a cruciform paradigm of discipleship emerging. So Jesus' suffering is not just the means by which we are saved, it's the pattern upon which we live. And what we see in Mark is that the cross brings forward failure. And failure gets incorporated into the very journey of discipleship. The first failure happens in Mark 8:27-35, when Jesus announces his death and Peter tries to dissuade him. It's interesting, it comes after Peter confesses that Jesus is the Messiah, which is an important declaration. But Jesus does not validate that declaration. Instead, he rebukes them and tells them not to say anything to anyone. Why? Because as Peter will show, his perception of the Messiah does not accommodate a Messiah who suffers. Peter has a paradigm of power, and he's trying to accommodate Jesus to that paradigm. But the point of Jesus is, I'm not just a Messiah, I'm a crucified Messiah. His authority and his identity is inseparably intertwined with his suffering. Now, Peter doesn't want that. And here we see the one fundamental failure, or the first fundamental failure of discipleship, self-preservation. Peter doesn't want a crucified Messiah because he doesn't want to die. And Jesus answers with the most emblematic discipleship teaching in the gospel. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Discipleship is this paradox. You lose your life to save it. There's no discipleship without the cross. So if we're asking how to make disciples, well, we have to teach them to carry the cross well. We have to teach them what that means, what that implicates. The second failure happens in Mark 9. After, again, Jesus predicts his death, the disciples engage in this private conversation among themselves about who's the greatest among them. Almost a comical scene. I'm going to die. Great, great, great. Who's the greatest? And here we see the second fundamental failure, which is self-promotion and greatness. The darker side of this failure is that in seeking to be great, they end up pushing out the little ones. Mark brings two stories at this stage that are very meaningful. The first is John coming to Jesus saying, we found someone who's casting out unclean spirits in your name, but we tell them to stop. We stopped him because he's not one of us. You see, as soon as they understand that they are disciples, they want to close themselves. Folks, that's a tendency, right? As soon as we identify who we are, especially if we're suffering any sort of ostracism or persecution or opposition, we close ourselves. And we establish clear boundaries to say who's in and who's out. And then they send away the children simply because they were children. Those who want to be great push out the little one and the outcast. In Jesus' corrective, he calls a child, puts the child in the middle and says, if anyone would be the first, he must be the last of all and servant of all. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. Jesus ties himself and the Father with the little one. You see, sometimes we think we need to help the poor and the outcast because they need us. No, folks, we help the poor and the outcast because we need them. The crucified Jesus leads us to those who suffer, and being with those who suffer essentially shapes our discipleship. We need to be in touch with the suffering of the world because that preserves who we are. Finally, the last failure, James and John ask for positions of glory in the kingdom. And this is the third fundamental failure of discipleship, pursuit of power and glory. And here's how Jesus answers. You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be the first among you must be the slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. So discipleship confronts our failure and shapes us in the mode of the cross. To our self-preservation instincts, the answer is self-denying, self-giving. To our self-aggrandizing, self-promotion instincts, the answer is humility and serving the little one. To our self-glorification instincts, the answer is the service to one another. Why does that matter? Well, I hope it's self-evident, but three statements here to summarize. You cannot have discipleship without suffering. You can't understand discipleship without suffering. We can't understand the nature of discipleship if we don't understand the role that suffering plays in following Jesus. The church, the community, is a community of disciples that is close to the sufferings of the world. Second, failure is part of discipleship. Thank God. It's the way we learn. We learn what it means to be a follower of Jesus as we are confronted with our own shortcomings. Now, it is important to exegete our failures, to ponder on our failures as we learn what it means to follow Jesus, because failure is a part of discipleship. And third, a disciple is formed in self-giving service to the little one and to one another. Service is the very mode of discipleship. We don't become disciples simply by reflecting on discipleship. We become disciples by serving, and serving the little one, and serving one another. So in conclusion, what is discipleship according to this broader paradigm? Discipleship is an identity. Discipleship is a relationship. Discipleship is a mission. It's covenantal in nature. It's eschatological in its orientation. It's cruciform in shape. It's missional in character. There's so much more that can be said here, but I hope this will tease your appetite and capture your imagination. Because one thing that is important here, as practitioners, as pastors and leaders, we are not masters. We are not rabbis. There's only one master, and that's Jesus Christ. We are facilitators. You know, a good image for us, we are like Philip, we do discipleship like Philip did with Nathanael in the beginning of the Gospel of John. Our role is to bring people to Jesus. It's come and see. It's to bring people to Jesus and walk and follow Jesus alongside them. And perhaps in this process, the questions that we should ask ourselves are, how do I keep my community close to this paradigm? How do I help those under my care to paint themselves into the story of Jesus? May the Lord help us to follow Him and to help those we love to follow Him. Thank you very much.
Amen. I am so grateful to have been there in person when Dr. DeCampo shared these wise words. And it's great to be able to go back and listen and catch things that I missed the first time. But I want you to actually be there in person next time too. If you're in the Portland metro area, these gospel gatherings happen about 4 times a year. And I promise it's so much more fun to listen live in the room. If you are encouraged by this talk, join us next time in person. You can find all of our upcoming gospel gatherings on our website, togetherpdx.org/events. See you next time.